Thinking Liberty, Episode 6.
Welcome to Thinking Liberty, the podcast that explores lifestyles of freedom-minded individuals. Join us as we discuss work, hobbies, health, learning, and more while living a travel-orientated lifestyle. Be curious, be open, be inspired, be free. And now, here are your hosts, Zach and Sarah Varnell.
Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of Thinking Liberty. We're here in an Airbnb in Atlanta, and that's our studio for this week. I'm Zach.
And I'm Sarah, and as Zach said, we're on the road this week, but we left our RV behind. We're heading out to Las Vegas, so by the time you listen to this, that's probably where we will be. We're going to meet up with some friends next weekend for a music festival, but we're going to head there a little early and check out some of the sites there. We were there a few years ago, but it's been a while, so we definitely want to check out some shows and go back to some of the highlights from our last trip. We left the RV and the pup, unfortunately.
Yeah, we missed him.
With my parents on Lookout Mountain. So he's in good hands. He'll be very spoiled when we pick him up.
Yeah.
But we wanted to spend the weekend before our flight in Atlanta. It's just a very quick pit stop, though. So we really haven't been able to see many of the people that I would have loved to have caught up with. A lot of our friends probably don't even know that we're here because it's just been such a quick in and out. But definitely next trip, we are going to set aside more time because I definitely want to catch up and chat with some of these people. But we did have a chance for a quick brunch, and we attended a friend's wedding, and then we actually did a pretty cool interview, in-person interview, that we'll share hopefully next week with you guys.
Yeah, our very first in-studio, so to speak, interview, and it was a lot of fun. I think it went really well.
Yeah, I think it'll be pretty interesting for you guys. So traveling and planning your life can be pretty challenging when you're living mobily. You know, we always plan out our tentative trips, tentative route, tentative dates. But something I've heard from others and that I think really reflects some of this challenge is that we no longer live on a standard time zone. We're now in digital nomad time zone. So we're nomads, and there's no way to really predict where we'll be, when we'll be, because things change last minute all the time. And I think that's just pretty cool way to look at things. So we actually booked our trip to Vegas late last year, early this year. Mm-hmm. So at first we had no idea what city we'd be flying out of. We were just like, we bought our tickets to the music festival. We booked rooms with our friends, and that was it. We were like, all right, we'll just have to wait on the flight for a while.
Yeah, I think we originally booked the flight. We were going to be flying out of Philadelphia because we thought we'd be in Pennsylvania this time, but you know, we'll be there soon enough, but that did change. And luckily, we booked with Southwest, and we're able to just change that flight.
Yeah, and we actually have a little bit of credit left over from changing it out, so that's kind of cool. So we'll definitely be booking more with them in the future. But yeah, so we actually got invited to a friend's wedding here in Atlanta, and so that kind of changed our plans, so that's why we decided to fly out of Atlanta instead. So we just decided to stay the weekend and catch up with a few people that we could, and then it also gave us a reason to circle back through Chattanooga in North Georgia, which I'm sure our family really appreciated, because I think this is the longest that we've stayed away since we've been digital nomads. It's been since January when we left, so.
Yeah. And since you're mentioning, you know, changing plans and all that too, I'm just now remembering we weren't even intending on going to Vegas this early when we first booked this trip. We were going to go in the very first few days we were there was going to be the days of the music festival, and we were going to stay for a week afterwards. Mm-hmm. But we completely changed that too, just because, I mean, it sounded good at first, you know, fly from Philadelphia, do the music festival, and then stay another week. But, you know, once we looked at our calendar, this made more sense, and we, you know, we're getting into Vegas early now, and then we're doing the music festival and coming straight home. And then actually I have to fly to Vermont for work.
Yeah. So it's a good thing we changed our plans.
Yep. It wouldn't have worked out otherwise, but it's going to be a busy 2 weeks for me and for you.
Yeah, so it's definitely interesting, you know, trying to plan things and get things all routed. And as a friend of ours has mentioned, you know, when you travel, you really kind of have to learn to let some things go, and not, you have to take opportunities when they pop up and just kind of jump at chances. And we've definitely been learning that a lot. You can't plan everything 100% of the time. It's just, you have to kind of go with the flow, and that's what we're kind of trying to do here. But it's been really fun so far, and it's one of the advantages, I would say, of living in an RV, because you really can pick up and go. And at the same time, like we've done now, you can leave the RV behind and hit up an Airbnb, and that's been pretty nice so far.
Yeah, it's been great.
So we stayed the weekend in Atlanta, and for those of you that don't know this yet, I love having things or traditions. And so when Zach and I lived in Atlanta several years ago, we lived really close to this restaurant called La Fonda. And it's a chain restaurant in Atlanta, but I'm pretty sure it's just local to Atlanta. There was some place called La Fonda in Texas, but it was not the same. It was disappointing. So it was definitely in our top five favorite places to go. And we went there quite frequently when we lived. I mean, it was just a couple minutes down the road, so sometimes we would even walk or bike there. But when we were planning our move, we had just bought the RV, and so we were going back to our house, and we decided to stop at La Fonda for a late lunch. And while we were there eating our enchiladas and chips, we were just discussing our plans and what we were going to do and where we were going to travel with the RV. And so it was just kind of a cool little memory that we have. So now we always make it a point to stop at La Fonda whenever we come through Atlanta.
Yeah, we look forward to it, and it never disappoints either. It's really good.
Yeah, I mean, they have great food, great service, sangritas, which is where they pour their frozen margarita into a glass of sangria. It's really good. And then we were also taken by a friend to a place that he described as La Fonda for tacos. It was Mama's, is that what it's called?
Yep, Mama's.
Yeah, and it was really good. Very cheap, very kind of a out-of-the-way place that you would probably just drive past if you didn't know how good the food was. So I definitely recommend it. We went by Greens to pick up some local beer. They always have a great selection, great choices. And then I wish that we would have had some time to hike, because there are a lot of places in Atlanta and outside of Atlanta, because we are the city within a forest for hiking. But we didn't have time this time. But we'll definitely dive into more of that and more of some of our favorite spots in another episode. But today we really are going to switch things up. Zach actually had the pleasure of being a guest on another podcast. It's called the Renaissance Man Podcast. And Marco, he's the host there, and he's exploring the non-standard, unique ways that people are living their lives and achieving their goals. And on his show, he has guests, and they talk about careers, travel, hobbies, skills. He's really got some pretty interesting episodes, so I really recommend that you check him out. He himself, Marco, has a pretty interesting story full of travel and adventure. He says he's been an immigrant 3 different times, and he currently lives in Arizona. And he and his wife actually just, I think this last weekend, purchased a camper of their own so they can be more mobile and take some more remote trips, because he works remotely.
Yeah, I mean, I can't speak highly enough of his show. Even before he reached out to get me on it, I was listening to some episodes, and it was great. You know, he had some people on there that I was familiar with and some people that I'd never heard of. You know, he has a really interesting story, like you said. So, you know, listen to the interview and be sure to check him out at trmpodcast.com and follow him on the social media too, which you'll find at the same handle, trmpodcast. It's really good stuff.
Yeah, and I really enjoyed listening to this interview myself. I think that, you know, you'll get to hear some cool things from Zach about how he got started in information security and a little bit more background on how we got started living remotely. So it's a pretty cool interview. So I hope you guys enjoy it and get some things out of it. And yeah, we'll see you at the end of the episode.
All right. I am so stoked for today's conversation. We're talking about being a digital nomad. My guest is Zach Varnell. Zach, thanks for being here.
Hey, I'm glad to be here.
I'm excited to talk to you because I'm super interested in everything digital nomad. And you've been doing it, from what I understand, for almost 2 years now. Is that right?
Yeah, we're coming up on our 2-year anniversary now of living in our RV and traveling the states and just kind of living the digital nomad lifestyle.
That's awesome. All right, so let's start. I think the first question I have for you is something that everyone wonders about when they hear about this lifestyle. That's, what are you doing for a living? What do you do that allows you to work from anywhere in the world from the comforts of an RV?
Well, luckily, I already had a remote job when I decided to do this. And in fact, I worked from a house in Atlanta for about a year before it dawned on me that this is something I should be doing. I just happened to get lucky and get a job with an information security company that is completely remote. Like, we have people working from Argentina, California, just all over the place. It doesn't really matter where you live as long as you have access to, you know, the internet and an airport. So we've been doing that, both me and my wife, at the same company for about 2 years now. Longer than 2 years. We've been traveling while doing it for 2 years. But before that, we were just doing it from the comfort of our stationary home. And then we decided at one point to move into an RV and go from there.
That's interesting. So this company never had you come into like a central office? You were always working from home?
Basically, we've had a few different office locations since I've worked here, but for the most part, they've gone unused because everybody loves working from home, or people aren't even nearby the headquarters, so they don't come in. When I'm in Atlanta, I like to meet up with people and go, you know, work with them, but most of the time I'm not. So we're almost completely working remotely, and so is everybody else. And that did take me by a little bit of a surprise when I first got the job. I had no idea because they had a physical address listed. I just assumed that's where I'd be working from. And then, you know, my first day rolled around, or, you know, a few days before, and I'm asking where to come into. And they're just like, oh, you'll be working from home. So in a way, I lucked into it.
Oh, yeah, that's super unusual. You were totally expecting to go into an office. So you said the company's based in Atlanta, and you were in Atlanta then when you applied, or did you have to like do any kind of in-person interviews, or how did that work out?
Yeah, I was in Atlanta then, and the company's headquartered in Atlanta, and I did two in-person interviews, but they were very informal since it was such a small company at the time, and still really is. It's growing, but it's still small. But really, we were just meeting up at like taco shops and places like that. So it probably should have, you know, been a red flag to me, or maybe not a red flag, but a good flag that it was remote work. But I still didn't realize it for some reason until it was almost time for me to start.
That is interesting. Okay. So I found that most people doing the digital nomad thing have jobs or doing work revolving around IT. That mm-hmm. seems to be the most common thing. It's not what everybody's doing, but they're most likely utilizing the internet in some way to give them that flexibility and that freedom. So you mentioned that you were in information security, you said. What is that?
So it's a pretty big field, but my part of it is information security, especially application security. So I get to test applications, web applications, test networks, test companies, and find their vulnerabilities and report on them. So in a way, it's like being a hacker for good, which, you know, I've always been interested in, and it was always what I wanted to do. So now it's just the cherry on top that I'm able to do it remotely and also do the other thing I have a big passion for, which is travel. There's also other things you can do in the field, like my wife, who works for the same company. She does more policy-based stuff, where she might help a company become PCI compliant if, for instance, they're going to handle credit cards, or become FedRAMP compliant if they're going to work with the government and things like that. I don't know as much about that, but my, you know, side of the house is more, you know, kind of the ethical hacking and vulnerability scans and things like that.
That's so interesting. I have always been really interested in hacking, and so are you what they would refer to as a white hat hacker?
Yeah, I think that would fall under what I do. You know, white hat, and then ethical hacker, and then, you know, I usually just call myself a pen tester, an information security consultant. It's all pretty interchangeable, and, you know, it gets the idea across that you're doing it legitimately.
Yeah, I don't know if I'm using these terms correctly, so feel free to correct me. I just always imagine, like, when I heard the term white hat hacker and black hat, that it was like spy versus spy, like those old cartoons. Like, there was like maybe a good one and one using his powers of hacking for bad. Is that kind of right?
I think that's the imagery they're trying to get at, and especially, you know, cowboy imagery too, where, you know, the sheriff might be wearing a white hat, and then, you know, the cowboy riding into the town to shoot the place up is wearing a black hat, so.
Oh, yeah, that probably makes more sense, because I think in Spy vs. Spy, they were both bad. Like, I think, I'm not sure, I didn't. I don't know.
That's a little before my time, even. I know my brother had those, but I wasn't allowed anywhere near them.
All right. So you're basically like, is this right? Like a MasterCard or some big company will say, hey, we just have this new system in place, but we don't know if it's secure, how vulnerable it is. Then you can try breaking into it and seeing if you can exploit any weaknesses and then report back to them.
Yep, that's exactly right. Sometimes it's as narrow a scope as an application or a piece of an application. But then the really fun stuff that I get to do sometimes is what's called red teaming, where a company will say, hey, this is our company name. Go out there and find anything you can and try to exploit that. And that can be, you know, attacking their social networks, phishing their employees through email, attacking their web applications, or even breaking into their office, which we've done. So that's, you know, the fun stuff that, you know, we get to do. But then the not fun part is the week after, where we have to write a huge report on it. But it's worth it.
All right. So if this is really interesting, if someone is interested in this career field, what steps do you recommend they take to go down this path?
You know, there's a lot of ways into it, I think, and it's a very hard field to get into. I feel like I got pretty lucky and I met a guy who gave me a chance because he could tell that I was very passionate about it. And then, you know, I seized upon that chance and really, you know, proved myself. A lot of people, or I have a degree in information security from a university near Atlanta, but that's pretty unusual for you to see somebody with a degree like that. And I don't think many degree programs like that even exist anymore. Most people that I work with either went to college for something, you know, tangentially related, like maybe computer science or maybe mathematics, or don't have a college degree at all. And were just very passionate about this from a young age and taught themselves and absorbed anything they could. And that, I think that actually makes up the majority of our company, is people who just were super passionate from the beginning and were on the internet probably 24/7 studying this. And then eventually, you know, they're able to prove themselves to somebody hiring and get on board.
Yeah, I don't know anything about this. I mean, I'll tell you the extent of my computer experience. I know HTML and I know how to like take computers apart and put them back together. But that's kind of it. So where do I go? Do I start like just Googling how to hack and start taking like there are courses, or it's just something that when you go down this rabbit hole, you discover this whole world out there of people doing this and teaching each other how?
Yeah, it can be hard because there's a lot of bad information alongside the good information. If you Googled how to hack, I'm going to guess you're going to come a lot, you know, along a bunch of bad stuff that's not going to really teach you anything and maybe scammy or even trying to get you to install malware on your own computer or something like that. Really, you have to think like an attacker. And that's something that I think I've always done since I was a kid, even though I've never really been malicious at all. I've always thought, like, you know, I see that security mechanism, or I see the way this is supposed to work. What way should it not work? And what would happen if we did that? So I think that mindset goes a long way to, you know, becoming an information security consultant or an ethical hacker, just because it kind of influences your daily life. You see, you know, some security vulnerability just out and about, and you kind of chuckle to yourself and things like that. And from there, you just kind of, you know, explore those rabbit holes and start doing it online and looking into the software that you're using and things like that. And before long, you know way more than you did a year earlier.
And so coding must be pretty central to your life then, right?
It's very helpful, but I don't code nearly enough. I think I leverage tools that are coded by other people way more than I code my own. And it's great to know how to read the code and understand it, but I don't find myself writing code from scratch very often.
Okay. I'm just trying to wrap my head around someone who's interested in this, and granted, someone who's interested in this has probably found an outlet for that interest and that creativity. I'm trying to wrap my head around it as someone who doesn't know this stuff. So, and eliminating the university path, because this show is all about alternative paths to success. So if we eliminate someone says, I don't want to go to university and I want to start at a younger age than that, and you definitely don't want them to Google how to hack in case they like download some malware, get on some like Homeland Security watch list from the beginning or something. Can you give me something else? Like, how could I look into this and start honing my skills? Are there like message boards? Are there forums where people talk about this?
Yeah, I'm sure there are, and I'm actually not current on any of them, so unfortunately I can't give any leads on message boards or forums, because they're constantly changing. You know, they'll go under and a new one will pop up. But there are bug bounties, which is where companies will pay people to find bugs in their website. So you're completely given permission, for instance, to go try to hack Google within certain parameters. Like, you're not going to be able to fish their employees or, you know, break into their office or anything, but you can go and try to, you know, find bugs in Gmail or Google Drive or anything like that. And if you report them, you actually get paid. So I know at least one person in our company came from that background, where he had jobs that he didn't really care for, but in his spare time, he would do bug bounties for just a whole host of companies, make a little money on the side, and build his resume. And, you know, it's funny that you mentioned, you know, excluding the university route, because when I got this job, they didn't even ask where I went to college. I don't think they cared at all. It was more about what I knew, you know, how passionate about it I was, and, you know, my writing skills, things like that, which some of it I'm sure I learned in college, but I think most of it, the information security aspect of it, I've learned outside of school. Because in school, it was almost like they were too afraid to teach you some of the more offensive methods of information security, like the ethical hacking and stuff. I guess they didn't want to be responsible if some kid did use it for bad.
Yeah, that makes sense. But so did you go into college already knowing quite a bit about this field, or was everything fresh when you started this degree program?
I guess for my age, I knew a good amount. You know, I'd always been interested in IT. I'd worked with computers for a while, even before college. But I still didn't know a ton compared to, you know, what I know now, or even what I knew when I first got the job at this company. So I've, you know, been proud to have improved every year, even in college when, you know, I was focused on studying and getting through college and learning as much as I can outside of school. And then even since I've gotten the job, I've really, one of my goals has been to look back a year in the past and know that I know a lot more than I did then. So.
Do you find that a lot of your coworkers, that they gain their experience by working for other companies that showed them the ropes? Because they, like you said, most of them didn't go to college.
I think so. A lot of my teammates did work for another company who I think, you know, gave them a shot and allowed them to prove themselves, and they did. And they worked for that company for a while and moved over to our company. And then some others are brand new, so they're kind of going the route that I went, where my current company is the one giving them the shot and allowing them to prove themselves and, you know, gain experience in this field.
And so what are these companies, what do they advertise when they're looking for prospective employees? Do they just say, you know, some computer experience required, or are they mostly looking for people with the right attitude? Like, when these entry-level jobs in this field, what do they typically look for, you think?
For entry level, I think attitude goes a long way. And I've been on the hiring side, where I will kind of weed out anybody who doesn't seem serious or not committed. And really, it doesn't seem that difficult to get my attention. If you're super passionate about it and you follow through on the things that I ask you to do, like we may give a small test, like, you know, the name escapes me right now, but there's software that is intentionally vulnerable. And we might give a test, like go out and attack this intentionally vulnerable software and give us a mock report on what you found. Basically, if people do that at all and their writing is pretty good and their, you know, techniques or techniques isn't the right word, but if, you know, they seem to go about it the right way, then, you know, we'll probably give them a shot in an entry-level job. But you'd be surprised how many people just don't do it at all. They never get back to me. They don't seem to care, or maybe their writing is just terrible and we can't justify bringing them on. But I think, you know, attitude, the kind of hacker mindset, and then just the willingness to follow through and work hard is, you know, goes a long way to getting you that first job.
Yeah, no, I wouldn't be surprised, because I've been on the hiring side of companies as well. And especially with small companies that I've worked for, and when we've had to hire someone, the main thing, the absolute number one thing that we've always looked for in our applicants has been someone with like a self-starter, go-getter attitude who doesn't need to be directed to do their job. Like, they can see a problem and they can recognize that it's a problem. But a lot of people right there, as soon as they find a problem, they'll just stop and then they'll go and call a manager or whatever and say, hey, I ran into a brick wall here. Whereas we're looking for someone, especially like a small company, we're saying, okay, but what steps have you done to try and see if you can solve this issue? Like that go-getter, self-starter, like treating it like your own business. And I would guess that with your company or even your field in general, if you're going to be working from home, you're putting a lot of trust and responsibility in these employees' hands. So you're looking for some kind of sense that you can trust them with that.
Yeah, it helps that I think we're project-based. So it's pretty obvious when somebody's not working because they maybe won't get a project done. But otherwise, people can basically work on whatever time schedule they want. And, you know, that especially is necessary when people might be working on different time zones. But we also have, you know, sort of flex hours where, you know, be available for meetings and be available for questions maybe during certain hours. But other than that, you could work in the middle of the night for all we care. And I've done plenty of that myself.
But. Yeah, I tend to be a night owl myself. Well, yeah, talk more about that. Talk more about the structure and the hours. So you said you're project-based. So does that mean you would get issued a task and then a deadline for that task, and as long as you meet it, you're good, and that's the extent of it?
Yeah, for the most part. Like, we have a managing consultant, and he kind of absorbs all the tasks from the clients and all the jobs that are coming in, and he schedules them out, and then he doles them out to the team. And, you know, they're usually about the same, maybe a week for testing an app, for 2 weeks for testing a company, and then a week for reporting. And that just gets put on our calendar, you know, well in advance. Maybe sometimes we're booked up for 2 months in advance or something, so I know what I'm going to be doing already. And then I just work on those projects and deliver them and start on the next one. And then maybe occasionally I'll have to go backwards a little bit and have a meeting explaining an old task to somebody, an old assessment. But for the most part, you're just moving forward like that. Yeah, and it's great. It offers, you know, the flexibility, like I said, of I can work in the middle of the night if I want to most of the time. Every one now and then we'll have customers who are really picky about when we work, but that's few and far between. And yeah, that's pretty much it. I think that you said to talk about structure, but I don't know if that there's too much of that. It's left up to us in a way to determine what our own structure is going to be.
And what about the hours? Do you find you're typically working a certain amount of hours a week, or does it just depend on the project?
It depends a lot on the project, but it usually comes out to about a full-time job, probably 40 hours a week. I do have some projects, and I've had some projects where I'm working nonstop for days, and I'm getting up early and staying up late. But then I'll have some projects where it's, you know, pretty easy, and I'm working normal hours. And I'll have some days, and they may even come right after those projects that where I'm working nonstop. These days where I'm not really doing much of anything because maybe I'm waiting on somebody else, and I'll just use that day for, you know, professional development or something like that. That is one thing, is it's never, you know, it's not really an even-paced job. Some days you'll be going crazy, some days you won't, and it's never the same thing, which I love about it. I've had jobs where I've done basically the same thing every day, and I couldn't stand it, so that's one thing that really appeals to me about, you know, InfoSec work, is you're constantly doing something different.
Oh, for sure. That definitely appeals to me as well. Like, every day, my day is different. I don't know what I'm going to be doing when I wake up, and I couldn't handle it if I was, you know, working in like a toll booth or something and every single day looked exactly the same. So I'm definitely with you. You know, I didn't plan on really talking a lot about this stuff with you. I was thinking more about talking about living in an RV and traveling the country and that whole experience. And I want to get to that, but this information security stuff, I think, is so fascinating for people listening into this, wondering what are they going to be doing with their lives. Maybe they're in high school, maybe they're in college, maybe they're older and they're just not like the direction that their careers are heading in. Like, this sounds really, really interesting. So I hope you don't mind if we like stick with it for a few more minutes.
No, it's great. And I think this is important to the digital nomad lifestyle, because like I always say, it's sort of the word or the phrase digital nomad is the steps laid out for you. You have to become digital before you become a nomad. So this is a great way for anybody who's interested to become digital, because I know a lot of InfoSec companies especially are starting to move to remote work and maybe even not having an office at all.
Yeah. So tell me, first of all, what kind of companies, well, I don't know if you want to give any specific names, but if someone's looking for work in this field, do they just search information security and look for job postings?
Yeah, I'm not sure about that. It's hard for me to say because I did sort of luck into this job. I just met somebody and I haven't been looking for a job at all since I've found this one. I'll go ahead and say the name of my company is Versprite. And it's a small company out of Atlanta, but we have, you know, big Fortune 100 clients and some small clients. And it's great. I love that mix. And once you get into the field of information security, you'll probably recognize a few big names. And I'm not actually sure what they do, whether they're in an office all day or whether they're remote. But I know there are other remote ones out there. None of them really come, you know, to the top of my head right now, though.
And have you found that this is a field that's primarily employing Americans, or are you finding there's a lot of competition for your services from like other countries outside the U.S.?
It's both. There's, like I said, a lot of our employees are from Argentina. We have at least 4 or 5 in Argentina now. We have a couple in Central America, and then the rest of ours are American. And Americans a lot of times are preferred because, you know, it's a long flight up from Argentina if they need to go visit a employee on site. But I don't know what it is about Argentina. They seem to really know their stuff, and the information security community down there seems to be huge and just full of a ton of smart people. So you'd be silly not to be hiring them.
That's interesting. So have you had any chance to go down there? You have any plans to go down to Argentina and travel with all this free and flexible schedule that you have?
Yeah, we're on the same page. Last year, around November and December, me and my wife decided that we wanted to go to Argentina and work down there with our co-workers that were from Buenos Aires. So we, you know, planned that and we flew down there. We worked in a co-working space, and we had an Airbnb for a month and a half in Argentina, and then we spent 2 weeks on our vacation in Chile. So I mean, it was great to be able to kind of intertwine, you know, vacation and traveling and our work like that, and plus we were getting to meet some of our co-workers for the first time.
That's amazing. I that's so many people's dream right there, is to be able to be working while they're enjoying and experiencing a different place and a different culture. I think that's absolutely amazing that you've found this. And even, I mean, you must pinch yourself like having stumbled into this.
Yeah, it's great. Since I've stumbled into it, I've actually become very interested in it, and I'm trying to see how other people are doing it too, whether this is a common thing or whether I just got extremely lucky. So.
Well, let's slowly transition into the more nomad part of our discussion. You mentioned that you're living in an RV, traveling the country, because you noticed that you're working from home, and really it wouldn't matter if you were working from home in Atlanta or whether you were anywhere else. So once you had this genesis for this idea, did you have to convince your spouse? Were you both on board? Like, how did that dynamic go? Because I've been there. I've been the one being like, hey, honey, let's move to Mexico, and having to kind of be the one seeking that change. Was that kind of dynamic there? Were you both just like, yes, let's do it?
That's a funny story, really, because we were living in Atlanta, but we still liked to travel. But we were traveling sort of like everybody else travels, maybe the 2 weeks a year going on vacation or whatever. And 1 year we had gone up on vacation, and I think we had worked a couple days while we were out, but we were visiting Pennsylvania to visit some family, and we had visited New York City, and it was my first time being there as a tourist. Other than that, I'd just been there for work, where I didn't get to see anything. And on our way back, it was me and my wife driving, and then, you know, some people were just asleep in the car, and we were talking, and we were both just like talking about how much we love traveling. We wish we could do it all the time. And at that time, we were thinking about buying a house. So we were saying, it's like, oh, when we get a house, we definitely need to have enough room to park an RV in it so that we can do some weekend trips. And my wife says she's not high maintenance, and she's really not, but she's saying, it's like, oh, no, I'm not going to go on trips in a small RV. If we're going to do it, we have to have a big RV. And I'm like, well, I don't think we're going to be able to buy a house and a big RV. And then she said, I swear she said it, even though she says I said it, and it was, you know, we blame each other for the idea that, you know, let's just live in the RV then. And let's not buy a house, let's live in the RV. And I think maybe if she did say it, it was joking. And if I said it, it definitely wasn't joking. But at that point, you know, I ran with it. As soon as I got home, and I couldn't wait to get home, I was researching this lifestyle because, you know, I'd heard of it before, but it never really come to the front of my mind. And I was seeing that was possible. And from there, I was telling my wife, it's like, let's really do this. Let's live in an RV. And it didn't take long for her to realize that I was serious and she liked the idea. And we started planning that, you know, a year from when we basically thought of it, we were going to start living in an RV.
That's so awesome. That is so awesome. So was your wife already in information security at this time? Or was there a question about, well, what are you going to be doing while I'm working from the RV?
Yeah, I think she was already working for the same company. She started out as an executive administrator and then worked her way easily for her into becoming an information security consultant. And I think at this time she was already an information security consultant. So, you know, the stars had already aligned for us and it just made perfect sense that we should be doing that.
Well, I am into traveling by vehicle. I'm actually looking at buying a camper this weekend, but probably nothing like your RV. Tell me about the RV itself. Let's talk shop here for a second. Tell me about the RV.
Well, I've been learning more and more about it in this last year. I sometimes look back at, you know, when we bought it, and I knew nothing about it, and I'd never really driven anything bigger than a compact car before I took this thing off the lot and got it on the interstate and took it to family's house to work on. But it's a 1999 Gulfstream Sun Voyager. And I don't even think Gulfstream makes motorhomes anymore. So, you know, it's kind of a gem, but I love it. It's old, but we've fixed it up a lot. The inside of it now just looks like a, you know, a cute small apartment more so than an RV. When we first got it, we just ripped everything out of it that was, you know, the 90s tacky RV style and just started putting in, you know, real curtains and real, you know, tile and things like that. So on the engine and stuff like that, I don't know too much about it, but I knew that, you know, it was a Ford engine and I'd heard that it was pretty reliable and it only had 30,000 miles on it when we bought it. So because I think somebody had basically been living in it and never moving it. So it's a reliable motorhome and the inside of it had a lot of possibilities and we've fixed it up a lot.
Yeah, I mean, I find that to be pretty common, like low mileage in RVs, because people buy them and then they find that they only take them out like once a year, once every, you know, 6 months or so. And so these things just never accumulate miles. So they're out there without any problems. People can find low mileage RVs.
And I think the average trip is like 500 miles or less, because people a lot of times won't even go very far from their home. I've noticed that when we're in RV parks in various states, most of the license plates in the RV park are from the state we're in. So it's just people camping close to home.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. I've noticed the exact same thing as well. So did you mention how long this RV was?
Oh, yeah, it's 36 foot, which is pretty long, but they do get longer than that. I think they get up to 40 feet. And I swear I've seen some longer than 40 feet. I might be wrong about that. It might be my eyes playing tricks on me, but there's some massive rigs. And I think ours is a pretty good in-between size. It's still big. And it's not something I like to drive all the time, but, you know, as long as we keep it on the highways and, you know, wide lanes and things like that, it's not too uncomfortable for me. And we like to go pretty slow anyway. We move, you know, maybe once every 2 weeks or a month or sometimes even longer. And the rest of the time, you know, we're just living inside it, which, you know, that's where it being 36 feet really pays off, as we have a little more room than say a trailer, a class C RV, which is where it looks more like a truck.
Yeah, you're right. There's this trade-off there where it's like, do I want to be more comfortable when we're stationary versus the annoying factor, the bigger it gets, it's harder to park, it's slower on the highway, visibility's tougher. So you found that you went more towards the big side, but it's paying off because you're not going from city to city every day. You're staying planted for a while. So I think that's good that you went bigger. What's the inside like? I mean, for people who aren't that familiar with RVs, do you have like, I imagine you have a big full-size bed and a little kitchen area. Is there a bathroom inside as well?
Yeah, we have everything you could want. A lot of times people refer to what we're doing as camping, but I don't really think of it as camping at all because, you know, when I've been camping, sometimes it's uncomfortable and you're cold or, you know, you don't have the amenities that you would expect in a house. But here we have just about everything. We have a stove, which is, you know, a little smaller than maybe a house stove, but it's still as much as we need. You know, we have a coffee pot. We have a queen size bed. We have a couch. We have a good setup for working where we have both have a desk and my wife has a nice monitor. We have a refrigerator, bathroom, just all these things. The only things that I think I would like to have would be a dishwasher and a laundry machine, but I don't think they would fit in here anywhere. Plus, most of the time, a laundry machine is available at RV parks that we're at.
Okay, so that was going to be my next question is, where are you typically staying when you roll into a new place? Are you going into like national forest, campgrounds, or RV parks?
Yeah, it's typically been either private RV parks or we've stayed at county RV parks, some state parks, things like that. I know a lot of people, especially when they get out west, they'll do what's called boondocking, where they're going on to land that's free to camp on. And then there's no hookups. You don't get electricity or water or anything. And they'll go out there with maybe a generator or maybe solar panels and just stay out there as long as they can before they're out of water or need to dump their tanks or something like that. And that's something that we're interested in, but have never really gotten to do because I think it's a little less common on the East Coast. And it's kind of a process to getting your RV to the point where you can comfortably boondock, and we haven't done that yet.
Yeah, and the other thing is, with the fact that you're working out of this vehicle and you need to, you know, you need to be making an income here and you need to be providing reliable work for your clients and your company, it's different than camping. You're right. You're not camping. You can't just be in the middle of the forest. So are you typically getting your internet via Wi-Fi from the RV park?
Wi-Fi at RV parks is notoriously bad. We've come into some exceptions, but most of the time you can just count on them not having Wi-Fi at all. And any that do have Wi-Fi, people will take advantage and watch Netflix or whatever else, so then that kills the bandwidth almost instantly. So we use a Verizon Jetpack MiFi service, which is a little more expensive than I would like to pay. But I find that, you know, bills in an RV tend to even out. You'll pay less for some things and more for other things. And internet is just one of those things we have to pay more for. But we haven't been anywhere yet where the Verizon service wasn't good and we couldn't get, you know, a signal to reliably work on.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, you're paying a lot for internet, but your heating and cooling costs are probably a fraction of what most people are paying for their houses, and you're not paying property tax and all of these other things. So I'm sure, are you finding that your cost of living is dramatically cheaper than if you were renting or having a mortgage on a home property?
I can only compare it to where we were living before in Atlanta, which I feel like we also had a really good deal on. So I wouldn't say it's dramatically cheaper. Some months it's been a lot cheaper, and then some months we've even paid more because we were in a really popular area, like maybe Florida during the winter time, and it gets super expensive there, and we could only spend so much time before we had to get out and go spend some time in some cheaper areas. But it, you know, just like the bills, it kind of varies and depends on where you want to be. We've paid almost nothing times when we've stayed with family. We've had family who, you know, wouldn't accept our money, and we tried to, you know, we bought them gifts instead. And we've had family that we've stayed with who let us pay for electricity and that's it. And then, you know, like I said, we've been in Florida during the winter where the parties were charging us an arm and a leg. But
yeah, I mean, with cutting down that cost, especially out west, because that's what I'm familiar with. I've never camped out. I've never camped like east of Colorado, I don't think. So I'm just familiar with like all the western states. And out here, we just have endless land and endless, whether it's Bureau of Land Management land, whether it's National Forest land, where you could go anywhere and spend indefinite amounts of time there. And if you're using your Verizon jetpack for your internet, you should be good. And yeah, you won't have those hookups necessarily. I mean, you can. There are campgrounds and things that have RV hookups. But, you know, I'm sure then your costs would get way, way, way down to almost nothing other than your heating and cooling and just, of course, your daily food allowances, which you're going to have anyways. But have you ever been out to the western part of the country?
Not in the RV. We've been out to California and Nevada and places like that, just traveling by plane. But in the RV, the most westward we've gotten has been Texas. And then we decided that we needed to go back home, visit some family, and have some, you know, work appointments and things. So we kind of headed back that way. We do eventually want to get everywhere, as you know, especially the West Coast, and spend a lot of time out there. But we haven't done it yet, and we're working on it.
Well, to make you feel better about your internet costs, all you have to do is go online to like Carnival or Princess Cruise Lines or anything and check out how much it is to have internet on a cruise ship. And then you'll be like, you know what? It's not so bad.
Yeah.
Because it's like an arm and
yeah,
a leg.
It's nuts.
Well, what would you say is the best part of this digital nomad RV lifestyle that you have? Like what do you wake up every day and you're so thankful for and you just absolutely love it?
I mean, I guess it kind of goes hand in hand with the flexibility of the job we have. I really love the flexibility of we can be just about anywhere we want to be. When we decided to go to South America for 2 months, it wasn't a huge ordeal. We just needed to decide where we want to park the RV and buy our tickets and pack our bags and go. So that was great, you know, not having a, you know, house to worry about or people to be going by and checking our mail for us or anything like that. It was a little bit difficult because we do have a dog, and that's one thing that, you know, anytime we travel or anywhere we travel, we always want to have a dog because we love dogs so much, and especially our current dog. But we brought him to Argentina with us, which was an adventure. It was pretty easy to get him down there, but on the way back, they were trying to tell us we didn't have the right paperwork or something. And I didn't really understand much of what they were saying. They didn't understand much of what I was saying. And we ended up paying somebody a lot of money to get our dog back into the U.S. But so there were definitely hangups. But, you know, in general, I just love the flexibility of it where we can decide to do something and all we have to decide is where to park the RV and then we do it.
Yeah, that's the dream, man. Like so many people would love to be able to do that. And I've kind of been on this kick lately of wanting to downsize, wanting to eliminate more of our possessions because we just have so much stuff. Like I just own so many things that, especially because I'm in the physical products business, I have just so much inventory that a huge portion of my house is dedicated to that. And I just want to downsize and be able to, I don't know, simplify my life. Was that a step that you had to take as well before you started this? Did you guys have to get like mini storage places and put your stuff away? Did you sell most things? How did that work?
And we definitely downsized. Basically, from the moment we decided that we wanted to do this and we set the goal of 1 year, we started getting rid of a lot of stuff. And we didn't do mini, well, we did store some stuff at a building owned by my wife's parents, but that was mainly like antique furniture and things that are not replaceable. And other than that, we gave a lot of stuff away. We just went to Goodwill or Salvation Army or whatever and dropped off bags of clothes and knickknacks and just things that weren't really adding any value to our life or we didn't use very often. We still need to do that. Like as we live in the RV, we still collect stuff, and it's just a tendency of ours to get more and more stuff. And every now and then we do it again and we downsize and give bags of stuff away. And, you know, I don't know. I've never tried selling things, but I'm sure that's a possible route too.
Oh, yeah. I mean, what you're talking about, I think, is totally natural here to accumulate possessions as you go. And then you must kind of feel like space is at a premium, like everything needs to have a purpose and it needs to be something that we use or else we just simply don't have the space for it in our mobile home. Is that right?
Yep. Basically, I've heard other RVers say that everything they own needs to have its own space too. So you should be able to look at an object and know exactly where it goes. And we haven't come that far, but that would, I think that's great advice, is to only have as much stuff as you, you know, can decide where to put it and have the room for it.
No, I'm totally on board. I mean, I think we've hit on two things that are key in my life when it comes to sleeping in vehicles. And I don't have like much RV experience, but I go camping a lot, and I have my Mitsubishi Montero, which I have like a bed built in the back of it, and I go camping all the time. And everything in there has its purpose and everything in there has its place, just because over the years I found that the camping experience is actually worse the more stuff you have. Like, you're better off, at least I find I'm better off wishing that I had something or like forgetting something than having too much stuff. Like, too much stuff is just makes the whole unpacking, setting up camp procedure so much more of a hassle. And then of course the packing up and leaving procedure, then your vehicle's all messy. Whereas if I forget something, there's usually some other tool or some other possession that you can make do with. And then the other thing that we hit upon was when people say like, oh, they think you're camping and you're not really camping because you have the comforts of home. I found that like you can sleep almost indefinitely away from, well, a house, as long as you sleep well. Like, you can be away from a house with a roof over your head, whether it's in a vehicle or in a tent. You can do it almost indefinitely if you sleep well, like if you have a good mattress. But it's when you're on like this little tiny foam pad or whatever, and you got aches and pains, that you just like want, you just want to go home after like one or two nights. So you guys are sleeping well, you have your possessions that you need. And so then I have to ask, what's the worst part? Because right now it's all sounding really good. What's the worst part of this lifestyle?
And there's definitely been unexpected stumbling blocks. Like, the most recent thing I can remember is that we were driving down the road just somewhere in Illinois, pretty remote, and then the awning on our RV just falls off. So it's things like that that you really can't even see coming. And I then got on the shoulder and drove really slow for miles until I could find some place to pull over and fix it and, you know, secure it into place. You know, especially with an old RV, I think things like that are going to happen. We've had, you know, leaky sinks and things falling and breaking while we're driving. A lot of it is things that you're probably going to deal with in a house anyway, like when it comes to leaky sinks or, you know, appliances breaking. But some of it is just unique to RVs, like things like shelves crashing in on themselves because you were traveling down a bumpy road or something. And, you know, you get through it, and then most of the time you find a better solution. And we found that a lot of RV parts stock are pretty flimsy, so when, you know, something crashes in on itself, we just replace it with something better. And after it's all done, and I don't feel too bad about it, we went through it, but our RV is better off for it.
Yeah, you mentioned that the RVs, you know, it's, since it's a 99, and you mentioned how in the 90s all the RVs had the same feel. Like, I don't know what it was, but it was all like this like really cheap kind of laminate chipboard stuff on the interior, mm-hmm. and then like the thinnest possible aluminum for everything else. Like, what is up with that? Like, that just persisted for like 20 years. That's what every RV was made out of.
It all took up a lot of room too. Like, we had all this, you know, laminated board, like you said, covering every window, and it jutted out like a good 2 or 3 inches. So we took it all out, and the RV instantly felt bigger after that. So I have no idea why they thought it was a good idea to include that in the first place.
Yeah, the style has not changed for a long time. Like, until like, I'd probably say the like 2010, 2000, like eight, like around there, I found the materials started to get nicer. But I took a 1953, I think it was, like little canned ham trailer on like a 2000 mile trip last summer up to Idaho and around the Pacific Northwest, and then back to Arizona. And it was the same kind of stuff, except instead of that like fake wood chipboard, it was plywood with aluminum. But it's funny, the technology was like the same for like 50 years on those things.
Yeah, the best RVs that we've seen is where people buy them and basically rip everything out and redo it, which is way more than we wanted to do. But if you're considering living in it for a long period of time, it's probably worth it.
So what would you say if someone wants to embark on this epic RV quest, how much money do you think they should set aside for buying a relatively reliable vehicle, having the amount of space that you have, maybe between like 30 and 35 feet, and having something maybe with similar miles? Like how much money would it take for someone to get into this?
Yeah, I think another thing that varies wildly. Like, I've seen people do it on a shoestring where they spent maybe $7,000 on their RV, but it wasn't super nice. And a lot of times those people will fizzle out and maybe not be doing it for very long. And then maybe some people will stick with it and improve their RV over time and be able to start on a small budget. Then we've also seen the exact opposite, where people roll into the park with what has to be a $500,000 RV, which I can't see myself ever doing that. And I don't know, I'm sure it's nice inside, but that's a little bit much for me.
Yeah, that's like the Meet the Parents RV that, like, Robert De Niro has, that has like all the features and everything.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever even seen the inside of one, but I'm sure it has to be nice. Like, you wouldn't even miss living in a house because it would have every amenity. But I think we took a more middle of the road, where we were okay living in an older RV, but it was still in great shape, and we knew that we could make it what we wanted it to be rather than requiring something to be already perfect for us. I think that goes a long way, and most people that I know that have RVs did that, where they buy one where they see the potential in it rather than what it is.
Yeah, I have some friends that they bought an old, like, 1970s Winnebago, and it was at the very, very bottom end of the spectrum that you're talking about, probably only a couple $1,000s, and just gutted it over the course of many, many years of living inside of it full time, to where now it's just this gorgeous, gorgeous home that has transformed over the years and that has cost pennies on the dollar when compared to the alternative. So yeah, you're right. You could really go any way that you want, depending on how much you want to spend and how dirty you want to get your hands and how long you want it to take, how road ready and comfort ready you want it to be. So
it also depends on if you need a motorhome, like we live in, and we drive our motorhome and we tow our car. But maybe if you already have a truck that's capable of towing a trailer, you'll probably spend less on a trailer than you would a motorhome. And then a lot of people have fifth wheel, where you have to, you know, it has like the gooseneck that you put in the back of the truck onto a hitch, and they're much bigger. But I don't really know the prices for them, but I'm imagining that you would be able to pay less for those since you're not paying for an engine or anything like that. But then the trick is you have to have a pretty heavy duty truck to tow those, so, which can be more expensive than motorhomes. But
yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. This is the eternal debate that people have when they're considering going down this path. Do they go with a motorhome that they can drive? Do they go with a fifth wheel they can tow behind a big pickup truck? Do they go with maybe like a small type camper or Winnebago? I mean, there are a million different ways you can take it. Have you found that your home is on wheels with a motor? Have you found that it's a pain sometimes when you need to go someplace in the town and you only thing you can drive is this 36 foot vehicle?
Oh, well, we tow a car too, so I don't think I would be able to get around in this around town. And I think, you know, the one time we did drive through a small town, I took somebody's mirror off, so I learned not to do that pretty fast. But yeah, we have a tow dolly, and I towed the same car that we had before we'd even decided to do this. So I would definitely suggest having a car or a motorcycle or something besides the RV, unless you're living in a tiny van. I wouldn't suggest driving your RV around at all.
Yeah. Okay. No, that makes perfect sense. Having that car is going to give you all the flexibility where you can stay in these different cities and places for long periods of time and be able to go to the grocery store and other things like that without having to move this giant vehicle or get an Uber or something like that. That makes perfect sense. what's next for you? You've been doing this for about 2 years now. Is it something that you just plan on doing indefinitely? Some international travel? What comes next?
Yeah, we're still in the process of deciding that ourselves. For this summer, we have a New England trip planned where we want to get up and visit family again in Pennsylvania, and then from there continue up northward and, you know, visit all sorts of states up there that we've never really been to, and, you know, while we're at it, stay cooler than we would be if we stayed in Atlanta or Chattanooga the whole year. International travel is still on our mind, and we might do something, but we haven't really made any firm plans at all. So right now, I think we're just going to focus on New England and kind of just take it as it comes. A lot of times, work trips will interfere with some of this. So there's no telling what'll actually happen, but that's the plan for now.
That's awesome. So just no plans to change out of the digital nomad lifestyle. Just keep at it. You're enjoying it. I really only have a couple more questions for you. And going back to the information security thing, which I just find super fascinating, this career field, can you give any idea in terms of salaries that people can expect entry level wise and then later on down the road for the different kinds of job positions that are available in this field? Because typically IT, I found, tends to be really a really well-paying industry.
Yeah, I think it pays really well. And, you know, of course, if you're in San Francisco or somewhere like that, you're going to expect a lot more. In Atlanta, I think maybe, you know, entry level, you might start out at 50 or 60 and then grow from there. And there's been, you know, I don't even know if there's much limit on it, because I've met, you know, big CISOs of companies like chief information security officers who I'm sure make a ton of money and have stake in the company itself. You know, in a place like San Francisco, I'm sure you're going to need to make almost double that in order to have the same standard of living. And I think that's one way that digital nomad or digital nomadery comes in very handy, is maybe you can work for a company that's based out of somewhere like New York or San Francisco, but live much cheaper by not staying in big cities like that.
Yeah, absolutely. Can you imagine getting paid like San Francisco salary and you know, living in Arizona or Tennessee? Your money would go so much further.
Yeah, that'd be great.
That's a lot like my guest from episode 2 of the podcast, Jonathan Lockwood, the voice talent, who's, you know, he's a voice actor and he's getting paid in American dollars, but he's living in central Mexico where the dollar is worth 20 pesos right now. So he's getting a huge bonus from being a digital nomad in a way.
Yeah.
I know where people can find out more about you, and that's because you have a podcast called Thinking Liberty, right? Where you talk about a lot of your travels. Isn't that right?
Yeah. ThinkingLiberty.com. Our goal is to interview other digital nomads, or really just anybody who's living the sort of lifestyle that they really want to live, rather than getting stuck in what they're expected to live. So that might mean living abroad or being a digital nomad or just being really into the city that you live in and loving every minute of it. And we do talk about our own travels usually. When we open up our podcast, we'll give a small update about where we are, what we've been doing, and things like that. But yeah, really, we want the focus of that podcast, which is really brand new at this point, to be other people's interesting lifestyles and how people can emulate those and, you know, put those type of changes into their own life to become more freedom oriented and more travel oriented.
So I'll link to that on the show notes page, which is going to be trmpodcast.com/20. Where else should I link? Anything else you want me to link to, Zach?
ThinkingLiberty.com is the best. We also have Twitter and Facebook, and that's both at ListenTL.
Okay, perfect. I will put that on there. So if you're listening to this and you are searching for an alternative path where you're making $50,000, $60,000 starting, and it can go up from there, and you have the flexibility to work from anywhere in the world, and travel is something that you've always wanted to do, then I would recommend that you get in touch with Zach, you listen to his podcast, and you learn about this lifestyle if it interests you, because I think it's super attractive and you're doing something very unique, something that a lot of people wish for in their daily grind, but that you're actually doing. Anything else you want to say And for anyone who's aspiring to do this, any words of encouragement or advice?
I think, as I hit on earlier, if, digital nomad, treat it like a checklist, become digital and then become a nomad. So, just look and explore any ideas and any ways you can to get, a more freedom oriented, more flexible job, and then go from there and just do whatever you want to do and whatever makes you happy in your life.
All right, Zach. Well, I've really enjoyed this talk. It's been absolutely fascinating. If you ever find yourself in the Phoenix, Arizona area, don't be a stranger. We can get together and meet up, have a beer, but I don't recommend that you come anytime between May and September because it's oppressively hot here.
Yeah, we'll try to spend some winter there. We'll definitely look you up.
There we go. All right, Zach Varnell, thanks so much for being on the Renaissance Man podcast this week.
No problem. Thank you.
All right. Thank you guys for tuning in, and I hope that this was enjoyable for you as it was for me. If you have any questions or you're looking for more information about anything that was discussed in the episode, or you want more resources for how to get started in information security, feel free to reach out to us. You can reach us at our contact page, or you can check out, we'll have some information posted for you at thinkingliberty.com. /episode 6. That'll be our show notes page for this episode. And definitely check out Marco's show, the Renaissance Man podcast, as well. And we'll link to that on the show notes page too.
Yeah. And be sure to follow Marco on all of his social media. I think he has Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. And I think they're all TRM podcast. And while you're at it, follow Thinking Liberty too at ListenTL for both Facebook and Twitter. Like Sarah said, our show notes page is thinkingliberty.com/6, and we'll try to post all the resources there that we can think of. Any links or whatever we mentioned during this episode will be on that page.
Yeah, and if you enjoyed this episode or any of our other episodes, please share them with your friends. Invite your friends to like our Facebook page, direct them towards our podcast. We definitely, want to provide some information to people who may be looking for different ways to live a more travel-oriented lifestyle. So if there are any topics that you'd like us to cover, or if you would like to come on our show to discuss how you make travel more part of your life, reach out to us as well.
And if you're enjoying the show and you want to help us out a little bit, be sure to give us a like, a rating, a review, any of that on whatever podcast platform you're on, whether it's Google Play or Stitcher, or especially iTunes, where we have a chance of getting on the new and noteworthy list this early into the show. So those things will help us tremendously. And again, just sharing it with your friends, because we're always, trying to get into more people's ears and let them participate in the conversation and talk about being a digital nomad or just whatever sort of travel-oriented lifestyle that may be interesting to them.
All right, so thank you guys for tuning in. That's all for this week. We'll see you next week with a new episode.
Thanks for listening to Thinking Liberty. Subscribe to the show for free on iTunes, Google Play, or Stitcher at thinkingliberty.com. You'll also find detailed show notes pages, articles by Zach and Sarah, and more. We'll see you next time.